We're talking with the head of the Wisconsin Humane Society here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Dozens of cats have been evacuated to Wisconsin for adoption as Hurricane Dorian lashes the East Coast. Meanwhile, the New York Times crunched numbers on euthanasia rates in big cities across the country. They found the rates have plummeted. We'll look at both of these issues with your questions and perspectives on animal shelters. Do you work at a shelter? What do you think is important for people to know about your work? Do you plan to rescue an animal threatened by Dorian? What are your impressions of rescue animals? We're at 800-642-1234. Ann Reed is president and CEO of the Wisconsin Humane Society. Ann, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
I'm so glad to be here. Thanks, Kate.
And how is the Humane Society responding to Hurricane Dorian right now?
Humane societies, and I'm going to use the plural because an important fact about this is there is no single national organization in our field. The commercials you see are for not for animal shelters, but for different kinds of advocacy organizations. So the Wisconsin Humane Society, based here in Wisconsin, other Wisconsin local humane societies, and really humane societies across the country that are out of direct danger of Dorian, are just networking furiously right now. And this is what happens before storms. There isn't a single organized effort. It's about relationships. And so people reach out. We reach out to folks we know saying, do you need help? And what came together for us this past weekend was, at that time, of course, it was Florida that was getting ready for the hurricane. And the key for disaster evacuation is actually not to evacuate the animals who are being displaced directly by the storm, but to evacuate animals who are in shelters already so that there is space for the animals who are going to be displaced so that families can look for them and find them locally. So what's been happening as Dorian sort of started to close in last week was shelters in Florida were looking for help getting the animals they already had out to where they would be safe and be able to be adopted. So we were privileged to meet 33 cats from North Central Florida Humane Society in Gainesville last weekend at the airport. They're actually already starting to find homes throughout our shelters. But you just multiply that by really hundreds of separate efforts trying to get these animals out of danger.
Can you take us behind the scenes with how these connections happen and these rescues happen from an animal shelter in the eye of a hurricane and, you know, the Wisconsin Humane Society that can take in at shelters around the state?
Sure. And we're so privileged to be able to have that capacity to do that. You know, one of the things that the New York Times article you referenced notes is a real strong increase in the professionalization, let's say, of our field over the last 20 years or so. And as that has started to arise and people have realized, yes, we're all separate. Yes, that might not be a good thing, but we have to know each other to be able to work together on stuff like this. So we meet each other at conferences. We get to know each other locally. And there are whole separate nonprofits that exist to move animals from place to place. So we move animals ourselves, the Wisconsin Humane Society, nearly every day between campuses and so on. But for this particular rescue from Florida, we worked not only with North Central Florida Humane Society, but also with a separate nonprofit called Wings of Rescue, that its sole work is to put animals on airplanes and get them from one place to another for all kinds of reasons. Disasters, yes, but just simple overcrowding as well. So it's a lot of email. It's a lot of phone calls. It's a lot of keeping up between these, let's call them opportunities, and really getting to know each other and understanding how we can help.
We're talking about animal rescues when disaster strikes with Ann Reed. She's CEO of the Wisconsin Humane Society. Have you ever adopted a rescue dog or cat before? What was the process like? Why did you decide to adopt? Do you have any concerns about adopting from shelters? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. And when the Wisconsin Humane Society has rescued animals, or taken in animals, I should say, from hurricanes in the past, what's the range for how many pets get displaced by major hurricanes?
It can easily be thousands. And so you have sort of two different ways that it happens, and we're kind of seeing the second one now. The first one is the classic. A huge storm is coming. We know where it's going, and the impact in one particular spot is going to be devastating. So Katrina, of course, is the biggest example of that. And literally thousands and thousands of animals from Katrina were placed all over the northern United States. We actually were using space at State Fair Park to hold them. So that's one way that it happens. The other way is, Dorian's a good example of this, and it's quite concerning, where there has been such doubt about the path of the storm. Obviously, that's very disruptive for people, but it's also very disruptive for shelters who are trying to plan. So shelters who might have thought they were safe last week when it was easier to plan how to get animals out, now might be planning for evacuation. So this particular storm is very much a moving target right now, and there's a lot of uncertainty about where we're going to end up.
So these shelters have to be really nimble as the hurricane moves. So after these shelter animals arrive in Wisconsin, and these dozens of cats right now, do they need any medical tests or treatments? And how does that go?
So we're actually transporting animals in from the southern United States every week in, week out, disaster or no disaster, because separately from weather, the other thing that drives this is that animal homelessness is falling across the country. That's a wonderful thing. But for reasons we'll be talking about in a few minutes, it's falling faster in the northern United States than it is in the south. And so there's still a great deal of overcrowding and very high euthanasia rates in the south. And it is a wonderful fact right now that many northern shelters, including the Wisconsin Humane Society, many others in the region, are routinely not only able to serve homeless animals from their own communities, but also to create room in our shelters for animals from the south who might die of euthanasia if they stayed where they were. So we've got really good routines for this, and so our 33 cat guests from last Saturday are no exception. We have veterinarians on staff. They look at what's going on. If the animal is not spayed or neutered yet, that's going to happen at one of our campuses. Vaccines are routine for us, and once we ensure to our own satisfaction that an animal is healthy and safe enough to be supported in a home, not necessarily perfectly healthy and safe, but healthy and safe enough to be supported in a home, off to the adoption floor and off you go.
Oh, so that animal is really stabilized and is able then to take, you're able to take the next steps with that pet.
Absolutely. Keep them healthy while they're with you is one of the most important premises of what we do.
Talking with the president of the Wisconsin Humane Society, Ann Reed. You can join in. Have you ever adopted a rescue dog or cat? What was the process like? Why did you decide to adopt? And what do you want to know about euthanasia at Wisconsin animal shelters? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick this up in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. There are some positive trends at animal shelters in big cities across the country. Spaying and neutering is more common, as are pet adoptions. New York Times collected data from municipal shelters in the 20 largest cities nationwide, and they reported a big drop in euthanasia over the past decade. Do you have concerns about adopting from shelters? Why have you not adopted an animal from a shelter? What do you want to know about euthanasia in animal shelters? Join in 800-642-1234. Tweet us WPR Mornings. Anne Reed is CEO of the Wisconsin Humane Society, and she stays with us. Let's go to the phones now. Carrie is joining us from Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Carrie.
Hello.
Hi.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have 6 rescued animals. They're not from weather disaster, but I've adopted all of them from the Southwood County Humane Society. I've got 3 dogs and 3 cats.
Oh, wow. How is it going, Carrie?
So far, so good. I mean, they sometimes fight like cats and dogs. You know, they have their moments, but for the most part, I wouldn't do anything different. I wish I would have done it a lot sooner.
Right. So you started getting animals from a shelter in 2013, I understand.
Correct.
What caused you to take that step?
You know, actually, it was my boss at the time. She's always on the internet. She always looked at the website. And one day she just came over to me and she's just like, Carrie, she says, you got to go on the internet. You got to check out the animals at the Southwood County Humane Society. And that's basically how it started. And then once you go there and you read their stories, it's just like you can't help but feel sorry for them. I just want to take them home and give them a place where they feel loved and comfort and safe.
Oh, Carrie, thanks so much for your story. Anne Reed, it's the pictures and stories that really compelled Carrie.
Well, and it's the carries that are so strongly driving the revolution in animal sheltering in the last 20 years or so. That is just a perfect single example. And if you multiply that by millions of people in the United States, you get the modern animal sheltering world. Everybody still remembers from their own childhood and from movies they've seen and cartoons and stories that animals come to the Humane Society in your community, wherever that is, and they, quote, run out of time, end quote, and then they're euthanized to create space in the shelter. And that is just not true anymore because of people like Carrie and her boss who are actively watching. Even, you know, Carrie, I love that story because she wasn't even necessarily looking for a pet, but actively watching the stories of these animals who are in shelters and coming in by the ones and twos like Carrie and her boss, and then by the hundreds and thousands to make homes for these animals.
Well, let's look more closely at these euthanasia rates that the New York Times found. They analyzed data from municipal government-run animal shelters in major cities over a decade. What do you see in those trend lines, and how do you compare it to Wisconsin?
It was in yesterday's New York Times. I have the paper version in front of me. I was so happy to see this article. And you just see mountain slopes down in city after city after city. And that is true in Wisconsin, too, and it is true in the Milwaukee area. Almost 50 years, in 1971, the Wisconsin Humane Society, which at that time was based in Milwaukee only, we've added other cities since then, brought in almost 50,000 animals and euthanized almost 35,000 of them. So almost a 70% rate of dying in the shelter. Fast forward to today, a tiny bit over 10%. We still are finding, and this will continue, really to either we feel it would be unsafe to put the animal out, or the animal is coming to us in a medical condition that we just cannot place with a family. The community needs us to be responsible in that way and to make the difficult decisions that a loving family would make if that animal were in a loving family's hands. But just an enormous decrease. And what you find in our organization, and we help lead the some of the policies and approaches that have led to this, and really across the country in so many cities where communities are willing to resource their shelters properly by donating and in municipal cases with appropriate municipal support, what you see is an absolute commitment that we're able to keep At WHS, we've been keeping this for 20 years. If an animal can be brought to be safe enough and healthy enough to be supported in a home, not perfectly safe and healthy, but safe enough and healthy enough to be in a home, that animal is always going to get a live outcome. We say as long as it takes, that's how long that animal has.
Let's bring in Tom now in Cedarburg. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I would like to point out that I think the dogs in particular need to be checked to see if they're vicious. And if they are, they should not be resold. They should be euthanized. My family's personal experience with a neighbor who got a shelter dog, and since the day they got it, it was vicious and would try and come after my family. And at one point, it came over the property line after my brother and his friend. And thank goodness the owner was not too far away. And it would not listen to her. She had to run up to it and grab it. And it was ready to attack. And so I'd like to point out that more than the temperament of the dog needs to be looked at before these dogs are resold.
Tom, thanks for the call. And how do you assess behavioral issues and the temperament of a dog?
The first thing to do is take it seriously. So there's actually a lot of voices in the animal welfare world, what you might call extreme or purist or fundamentalist, quote, no kill, end quote, approaches, where there's a lot of pressure on some shelters right now to get their euthanasia rates down by paying less attention to behavior. So we take so seriously, and I'm feeling right now like we have to really stand up and say, our larger community wants us to help animals, yes, but also wants us to support the community by being open to bring animals in when needed and to refuse to put animals out who are unsafe. That said, I will say it's quite difficult. We are doing our very, very best every day, devoting significant resources to this with behavior specialists on staff. We're taking time with every single animal before it goes out. But the quote-unquote science of this is difficult. Certainly there are some animals where you can tell right away, right? This cannot be a live outcome here and shouldn't be anywhere. But because of the shelter itself and the stresses that the shelter environment, even if you make it as great as you can, which we do, the stresses that the shelter environment itself puts on an animal are going to change the behavior of the animal just like they do with us. So we're doing our very, very best, and it is the most common reason for us why we're not able to get a live outcome for a dog is that we are concerned about behavior. The other thing I would say, I always want to catch a little bit when somebody says, I saw a shelter dog who, fill in whatever blank, was aggressive or was ill or was whatever, and say that's a data point that isn't actually related to shelter dogs. It's like I saw a person with freckles who was mean. That doesn't mean people with freckles are mean. This is a challenge, making sure animals are safe, that applies to animals from any source.
We're talking with Ann Reed. She's CEO of the Wisconsin Humane Society. And the Humane Society has really been urging dog owners to vaccinate their pets against this deadly virus called the parvovirus. Mm-hmm. What has concerned you about it?
Yeah, we're always concerned about parvovirus, especially when we see it coming in from the community. And we did see that this summer. So parvovirus is first of all, absolutely preventable in an animal by a very simple and common vaccine. So if you're seeing your veterinarian regularly, and you should be, you are getting your updated parvovirus vaccines for your animal, and that's great, and your animal is safe. What happens especially is that for puppies, they actually need a couple different boosters, essentially, just like kids. They need boosters of that vaccine fully on board before they're fully safe. And so what happens, and we see this in the summer, is folks take puppies out into places where they are encountering typically poop of other dogs who are out there who maybe were not vaccinated, and a puppy can pick up this disease. And so when we saw four puppies come in at our Racine shelter, this summer, we really wanted to let let the public know. It's a simple vaccine, but you need to get it. If a dog contracts parvovirus, number one, it's not curable. The best you can do is support symptoms and wait. And number two, your dog then is a risk to other dogs, and it can kill your dog in quite a painful way. So we really want people to check their status on vaccines and just go in and get that simple vaccine to prevent that death.
Anne, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm so glad to be with you. Thanks for everything.
Anne Reed is president and CEO of the Wisconsin Humane Society. Coming up, more schools are starting classes at later times. We talk about this growing trend and why schools across Wisconsin and the nation are making the switch. What do you think about starting school at 8:30 or later? How would that affect your family? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll talk about it after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about kids and sleep here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Academy of Pediatrics recommends that middle and high school students start school at 8:30 or later to give teens a better chance to get the amount of sleep they need. Madison's school district is undergoing a three-year process to move middle school start times later, 8:40 to be exact. So parents and teachers, what do you think about moving start times later or possibly earlier for some elementary schools as busing schedules are sorted out? Students, join in. If you're not sleeping and you have the time before school starts, we're at 800-642-1234. Sarah Sparks is with Education Week, and she's an assistant editor covering education research. Her blog is called Inside School Research. Sarah, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. It's good to be here.
So why has the trend of starting school later in the morning, why has that been catching on in recent years?
Well, I think school leaders are starting to think more about the science around how adolescents sleep. Adolescents sleep on a later sleep cycle, a circadian rhythm, than kids in elementary school do or adults do. And they have different needs to be able to be bright and up and happy and ready to learn in the morning.
Okay, so what does that rhythm mean? When do they fall asleep?
So right around adolescence, students can shift in their sleep cycle to really not start getting tired until 10 or 11 at night. And as a result, they also tend to wake up mentally also a good bit later. So they're really starting to wake up maybe 9:30, not 7 or 7:30. And if you add in all of the technology that they're using now that releases blue light, which approaches our brains like bright morning sunlight, it can also shift their sleep even later on top of that.
So how did we get here? Do we know why school start times have been in place for decades?
Really, tradition. I mean, 50 years ago, we didn't know as much about these sort of developmental sleep patterns. We certainly didn't have as much technology. And schools were designed originally for an agricultural calendar and a factory mode for the schedule. So they just thought early, regimented, when the bell rings, get everybody in, get everybody out. And most of the schedules were designed around the adult logistics of how to get the buses in, how to get the school schedule for the day set. And those things don't really take into account kids' developmental needs.
Yeah, but logistics are such a huge issue. You look at the busing schedules, and especially in large districts. And then you have the contact hours with the students, and you have what time lunch can be, and even after school, you know, the after school services. All of that is like a domino effect.
Absolutely. And in many of the school districts that I've seen that have experimented with starting school later or changing school schedules between the high school and middle school versus the elementary school, often they've seen very good grade effects, and kids are getting better grades. They're getting to school on time more frequently. They're getting to school at all more frequently. But what will end up causing problems with sustaining those efforts is they just get a lot of pushback in terms of when are we going to schedule the sports and the extracurricular activities? How are we going to manage the bus schedule? And sometimes parents not wanting their little kids, their elementary students, going that early, and they figure it's easier for the teenagers to go. But frankly, the exact opposite is true from a biological perspective. Little kids are usually easier to get up in the morning than teenagers, but these logistical issues end up causing a lot more problems.
Oh, the logistical issues often override the reason we really want to have these start times later for our teenagers. So here in Wisconsin, the second largest school district, Madison, has a few middle and high schools starting classes at 8:40 now, and some certain elementary schools will start at 7:50. What is your take on having different grade levels start at different times?
That seems to be a really common approach. And if you look, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends no earlier start time than 8:30 for adolescents. For younger students, an earlier start time is okay. And if you've ever been a parent of 5 to 7-year-olds, as I have, they get up quite early, right on their own.
No problem there, right? Sarah, what about lower-income students or rural school districts? How can adjusting to a new start time look different in that case?
That was something that's been really fascinating. If you look at districts like Seattle that has done a very careful study of moving school start times around, one of the really interesting things they found was low-income students and students who had longer commutes, they benefited the most from having these later start times. And it makes sense if you think about it. If students have a longer commute, which many low-income students do, or students who have to take multiple buses, multiple public transportation options to school, or they have family responsibilities and they're getting their younger brothers and sisters to school before they get to school, those kids are not only waking up as all kids are waking up for school, they're probably waking up an hour or two earlier than that to get everybody else taken care of before they get to school. And so they might be getting up as teenagers with a later sleep cycle, they might be getting up at 5 or 4 in the morning and getting just an extra hour of sleep anywhere they can get it really makes a big difference.
We're looking at trends in school start times with Sarah Sparks. She's an assistant editor covering education research at Education Week. You can join in. How do you see a good night's sleep affecting classroom performance? Would you prefer waking up at a later time in the morning? And athletes, would later school start times affect your practices or your games? What are your thoughts here? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Sarah, what do school officials usually say as for reasons to start school later? What are the health effects on teenagers when you put the clock back earlier for them to start?
So there was one study fairly recently in which they asked ninth graders to keep a checklist of all their daily activities, like when were they studying, how much were they doing extracurricular activities, and particularly how much they slept. And then they repeated that process in 10th and 12th grades. And they found that the students who were sleeping less, they reported much more trouble getting to class, understanding their lessons, struggling on tests and assignments. They also found that they were more likely to have confusion and depressed moods and other emotional issues. And these kids, even when they were taking that time that could have gone to sleep to study or do enrichment activities, it was the benefits of those were being outweighed by losing sleep to do it. Even losing sleep to study wasn't worth the sleep lost in terms of achieving on tests.
NPR talked with the University of Washington, a biology professor there, Horacio de la Iglesia, and he says starting school later is more in line with the natural wake-up times for teenagers. Let's listen.
You can send them to sleep, but they will lay in bed and they will not fall asleep. They will not be able to biologically fall asleep until midnight at least.
Until midnight. So if a student's not falling asleep until midnight, their next day could have, their next day could be miserable.
And frequently is. It would be funny to see if all teenagers were really getting 8 or 9 hours of sleep, even up to 10 hours of sleep, which is really their optimal sleep time, whether they would be quite as moody as teenagers are typically seen to be. But there are even districts at this point that who have not been able to schedule later start times, who are going as far as to set a study hall period first thing in the morning and letting kids nap, because it can be that severe that kids will be falling asleep in the middle of class. There was a recent survey by the Sleep Foundation that found 20% of parents of middle schoolers, so this is early adolescents, they were falling asleep in class on a regular basis because of a lack of sleep.
Middle schoolers falling asleep in class. They've also experimented, I think, in some high schools with these sleep cells where you can just put yourself in this cocoon for a while.
And it can really help. And again, particularly students who are the most vulnerable are the most in need of these sorts of supports. I have seen schools that are trying to be more supportive of students who have histories of trauma or very disruptive home lives. And often if they are uncomfortable at night or not feeling safe or not having a stable place to sleep, they're even more in need of getting sleep during the school day. And so if they don't have a later start time, I've seen school counselors and school nurses ending up letting kids sleep for 20 minutes during the day because it gets that bad, the sleep deficit.
Sarah Sparks is with Education Week. We're looking at school start times with you, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're looking at this trend going on, moving start times later at schools. Here's Madison's Chief of School Operations, Mike Herding, explaining the move last year.
The main catalyst for the change to a later start time for our middle school students was our own parents, who we've heard for the last several years that our current start time, 7:35, is too early for their middle school children. It does not work for them.
Does your child attend a school that has a new start time? What grade are they in? How is that change going? Are there conflicts you didn't expect? Is waking up later helping your teen feel better in the morning? 800-642-1234. Education Week's Assistant Editor of Education Research, Sarah Sparks, stays with us. Let's go to the phones now. Rick is joining us from Baraboo. Good morning, Rick.
Good morning.
So what's on your mind here?
Yeah, this is a very interesting topic for me as a former health and exercise physiology professor, and also as a parent, as a coach, etc. So what I'm learning is, or what we know is that the circadian rhythms, while kind of set by age groups, can also be adjusted. We know that because we have people that work second shift jobs, third shift jobs, and go throughout their lives really well. And what I seem to find is that this generation, this the group of parents that have grown up in the 70s and 80s, we kind of, I think we're dropping the ball with our kids, mainly because we grew up when there was really nothing on TV. You know, there was the news and Johnny Carson, and that was pretty boring to most of us. So what'd you do? You went to bed. And I think what we're doing is we've got more and more entertainment for kids, more and more options for kids.
Way too much stimuli.
Yeah, and we're letting our kids stay up later than we would have done in our generation. And I believe that that's definitely affecting things. Now, I'm not a big fan of school starting at, you know, 7:15, 7:25, 7:30. But I think 8 o'clock is a reasonable start time, especially if we can get our kids actually to bed. With my kids, it's by 9 o'clock, electronics are off. And by 10 o'clock, you can see they're tired. They're ready to fall asleep, and they fall asleep within minutes of going to bed. And I think that we just need to do a better job. Our generation has sort of dropped the ball on some of this stuff, either from not knowing or lack of information, or just not being, you know, that solid parent saying, hey, this is your bedtime. And I see that with my current students. Some of them staying up
Rick,
till 1, 2, 3 in the morning.
Rick, thanks so much for these observations. Sarah, 9 p.m., electronics off, 10 p.m., lights out, and kids are asleep.
Absolutely. One of the biggest trends that we see is as we have increased the screen time, and particularly not even the television screen time, but the laptop and phone and all of that, those provide different types of light and can very much keep students up later. Really good sleep hygiene makes a big difference. And as he mentioned, the turning off everything and getting the lights lower, really it should be about an hour before you expect kids to start going to sleep. And one of the rules I've seen that seems to help a fair bit is if the sun is out, if the sun has gone down, then the different machines and televisions and laptops and everything that have light that mimics the sun should also be out.
So that should be, everything should kind of be in sync as their world is growing darker. Let's go to Ed now in Minocqua. Hi, Ed.
Hi. My comment was that there seems to be not enough focus on the relationship between parents and children, because parents in today's world, as for many years, have had problems. They have to go to work. They have schedules themselves. And and children, especially at the high school level, should start adjusting for the life ahead of them, which will be you cannot have the the best circadian rhythm. You have to adjust, and then 'cause these are going to be parents too one day.
Ed, thanks so much for those thoughts. And Sarah, what about adjusting to the work world where, you know, a parent may not be able to adjust their schedule when their child goes from, you know, a 7:50 start time to 8:40 now when they're supposed to be at work at 8 o'clock?
Mm-hmm. And I'll say two things on that. One, from the kid's perspective, the good thing about the sleep cycle adjustment is it returns. both younger children and adults by sort of early 20s, their sleep cycle is shifting back. So then they are better able to get up earlier and get into work at a decent time as they get older. It's really associated with adolescence. But it is absolutely true that schools and districts have to work with parents to get these systems, to get any changes with schools set, but particularly changes that involve start times and parents' work times. In fact, there were about 40 different school districts, as well as the entire state of Rhode Island, who are all looking at ways to let principals find ways to adjust their school bus routes to take into account their changing populations. And very frequently, a school district's bus routes are set at some point, and then they stay that way for decades, even as populations, families come into one area or leave another area. And one of the things that they found was, even though the system was more efficient, was less expensive by a good bit, and was also better in terms of affording older students these later start times, parents were very difficult to convince, and the school districts that were able to make it work had parents that were informed and given options for childcare for younger students or different busing routes that would also allow after school programs. So getting parents on board and making sure that parents are able to deal with the rest of their obligations while also getting their kids to school, that makes a huge difference.
Let's bring in Noah now in Teresa. Hi, Noah.
Hello. I just wanted to comment. I don't think a lot of people think about high school age students and their part-time jobs along with extracurriculars and also doing studying and homework. That takes up a lot of time during the week, and that is also another reason as to why people, younger people, don't get to sleep, especially for lower middle class families. So that's my comment, and I just wanted you guys to elaborate on that.
Noah, what is your situation like?
All through high school, I worked since I was 15. We're a lower middle class family, so you know, that was 30 hours a week. And then, you know, I was a AP student, so I took all these AP courses and was very involved in school and theater as well. So those all took up a lot of time. I didn't get to bed till about 1 or 2 in the morning every single day of the week. So
lots on your plate there, Noah. Thank you for your story, Sarah. We have just a few moments. What do you hear from Noah?
I hear very similar things from teenagers, either who have jobs or who have a lot of extracurricular work or schoolwork. The amount of schoolwork over a week for high schoolers has increased by about an hour a week over the last decade. And I often see teenagers will try to recoup that sleep over a weekend, but studies have shown that really doesn't work. Once you've lost sleep, you've lost it. And trying to just make up sleep where you can lead to something that's kind of akin to jet lag for students. It's very difficult if students don't have a very regular sleep schedule.
Sarah, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sarah Sparks is with Education Week. She's an assistant editor covering education research, and her blog is called Inside School Research. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.